Chapter, actually. The next one's really long. It takes us all the way to the end of Bhumanda, maybe beyond. Yeah, text 12. We are in the Isle of Jambudvip and in the Bart Marshall. Remember, I pointed out how Prabhupada, in this context, always keeps referring to it as India. Yeah, we're on the minute here. So we have now the we already did the Upanishadic prayer here that was to Narayan Rishi, and then it says Gayati Chedam, and then he chants this, and then we have the verses. I think we did this one, how his senses are unpolluted, he sees everything, but his senses are unpolluted by what he sees, Prabhupada says. Yeah, here it is. Nadrig yasya gunayar vidushate. We did that one, so now here we go. Text number 13. I don't know if we'll get today to the next chapter. I've been working on it all day long, trying to give you a nice handout which outlines the whole chapter. And I ran into a mathematical problem. Or a Sanskrit problem, not sure which, but we'll see. So he prays here, O my Lord, Master of all mystic yoga, Yogeshwara, this is the explanation of the yogic process spoken of by Lord Rama, who is self-realized. Here he's called Hiranyagarbha, which he spoke. At the time of death, all yogis give up the material body with full detachment, simply by placing their minds at your lotus feet. That is the perfection of yoga. Place the mind, bhaktya, with devotion, in you, near gune, who has no qualities. Material qualities, but with devotion. And so Madhvacharya quoted something. One may have committed all kinds of sins, sarva papa kritaha api too, but if he's practice devotional service in his lifetime, liberation is guaranteed. And then Prabhupada quotes the Apichay Sudarashara verse, yeah. Then 14. Materialists are generally very attached to their present bodily comforts and to the bodily comforts they expect in the future. They are always absorbed in thoughts of their wives, children, and wealth, and are afraid to give up their bodies, which are full of stool and urine. If a person engaged in Krishna consciousness, however, is afraid to give up his body, what is the use of his having labor to study shastras? It is simply a waste of time. Now the body here is this in the next verse is called kalevara. Nasty. Ku is nasty. So Prabhupada, you see it here, ku kalevara right here? And it says, of this body which is full of stool and urine. But ku, you know, it's like sort of, yeah. Ku kalevara. Bad, nasty. So one should, by this time, one should be ready to give it up because of the... If despite practicing bhakti yoga and studying all the Vedic literature, one is afraid of giving up his bad body. You're attracted like, bad body, you bad body. It's like, which is the cause of all his suffering, what is the use of his attempts to advance in spiritual life? The secret of success in practicing yoga is to become free from bodily attachments. Well, that's how we measure advancement, actually. And then the last of these prayers. Therefore, our Master, kindly help us by giving us the power to execute bhakti yoga so we can control our restless minds and fix them upon you. We are all infected by your illusory energy. Therefore, we are very attached to the body which is full of stool and urine. Ku kalevaram arpitam. By your illusory energy. Except for devotional service, there is no way to give up this attachment and bestow upon us this benediction. So the exception, the aham mamartam, illusion of I and mine. Mamaham iti manyate. I am the body, and whatever relationship to the body is mine. So this is unless we practice this yoga system, our illusory attachment for this bad body, which is full of stool and urine, is impossible to give up. So these are the verses, the Ku Kalevaram verses, the bad body. So those are the prayers that he offers, just three of them. And plus the other one, the prose prayer. Now it goes on to talk about this is different now because the other varshas that was pretty much concluded, but now we go on to a little geography of Bart Varsha lesson, and it says here in the tract of land known as Bart Varsha, as in Ilavrita Varsha, there are many mountains and rivers. And here's an inventory of mountains. Malaya, Mangala, Prastamain, Nayaka, Kikuta, Shabha, Kutaka, and so on. Govardhan is in there. The Vindhya hills are there. Kamagiri. Besides this, there are many other hills and many large and small rivers on their slopes. So this is inventory here when you come to Bart Varsha. So this is why maybe he says it's like India. They're pretty much the ones we know. And then two of the rivers, then there's a list of rivers. Two of the rivers, the Brahmaputra and the Shona, are called nadas, or main rivers. This is very mysterious, but the answer is simple, that then there are other great rivers that are very prominent. They're called nadas because these two, Brahmaputra and the Shona, are masculine in gender. And all the rest are feminine. And here in the list, Prabhupada, you know, simply has this list of all the other rivers. He's following, he's following actually Bhaktisiddhanta. He puts those two rivers first, although in the, and you look, you'll see in the Sanskrit, they're not first. They're way down here. Where are they? Anyway, they're in there. They're down here somewhere in the middle, but he puts them first. Here's the Shona. And then it's, and Nadal, two rivers, Mahanadi. Mahanadi is apparently the name of a river. Some say that stands for the Ganges. Others say the Ganges is not mentioned because there's already been so much discussion about it. So these are the main rivers. The inhabitants of Bhartvarsha are purified because they always remember these rivers. Sometimes they chant the names of these rivers as mantras, and sometimes they go directly to the rivers to touch them and bathe in them. Thus the inhabitants of Bhartvarsha become purified.
Is that another typo on the second last word of the first line of the translation? So
huh? Where?
The first word is there.
I'm sorry?
Over to the right. There are the rivers instead of these are.
These are other great rivers.
Yeah, that's okay. It's not so right.
What is the reason for genderizing rivers?
I don't know.
Well,
Brahmaputra means, of course, the son of, since the Putra is the son, mm-hmm. The Shona, I have no idea. But everywhere else they're feminine. I don't know why. Sometimes the talk is the daughters of the mountains. We've seen that already. Mm-hmm. They could have been the sons of the mountains, but some.
How many of these rivers have been identified in present? You know,
the Prabhupada says Varadvarsha here. I don't know the rivers. I thought all the people from India would immediately know all the rivers. What about the mountains too, huh? I'm not sure. Some of them I recognize, of course, but not all of them. Of course, the names we chant sometimes, Godavari, Saraswati, and so on. Yamuna's there also. Sindhu. Now, people who take birth in this tract of land are divided according to the qualities of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. Some of them are born as exalted personalities, some are ordinary human beings, and some are extremely abominable. Sounds familiar, sorry. Born Bharta, Varsha, I have a hyphen. One takes birth. One takes birth exactly according to one's past karma. That's why. If one's position is ascertained by a bona fide spiritual master, and one is properly trained to engage in the service of Lord Vishnu, according to the four social divisions and the four spiritual divisions, one's life becomes perfect. All this is very much expanded from the Sanskrit, which simply says that apavarga chati bhavati. The Prabhupada is spelling out how you, if one liberation prophet, if one acts according to the divisions of Varna, So Prabhupada just says, train according to four social divisions ascertained by a bona fide spiritual master. In other words, not by birth, as far as Prabhupada's concerned. And so he's. Here's a big passage from the Vedanta Sangraha of Ramanuja. There's no translation here. Anyway, all these are in here's Prabhupada says, it's very interesting what he says here. In the land of Bhardvarsha, the institution of Arnashram Dharma may be easily adopted. At the present moment, however, certain demonic sections of demoniac sections of the population of Bhardvarsha are disregarding the system of Varnashram Dharma because there is no institution to teach people how to become Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, or Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis. These demons want a classless society. This is resulting in chaotic conditions in the name of secular government. Unqualified people are taking the supreme governmental post, and so consequently people are becoming degraded and so on. The Krishna conscious movement, however, is propagating all the world to reestablish the Varnashram Dharma system and thus save human society from gliding down the hellish life. Prabhupada says it very clearly. You can read in the early Bhagavatam, the first ones he wrote in India, how that it wasn't possible to establish Varnashram Dharma in Kali Yuga, and one should become a Vaishnava and simply transcend it. But he changed his mind about that, because just becoming Vaishnavas wasn't so easy either.
Yeah, I remember reading the early BCG. I think Karandar actually was the author, where he talks about establishing a Vanishram system as being a fanatical endeavor.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Well, that was Prabhupada's first, it was his first take of it, I think.
Yeah.
And then later on, he saw that people weren't becoming Vaishnavas so quickly. It seems that he rethought it. But it's very clear for Prabhupada how much he was against the hereditary, just by hereditary. And I heard a lecture that he gave in India, which was so heavy, which blamed the partitioning of India upon the hereditary caste system. He just developed it very thoroughly. He told in the lecture how, because of people who took their place in Varna, simply by no other criterion except hereditary, many unqualified peoples became Brahmins. They had birth, but otherwise no brahminical qualities. And because of that, because of these unqualified people, they mistreated the Shudras. They didn't take care properly of the Shudras. The Shudras became extremely discontent. So when the Muslims came, they were able to appeal to these Shudras who were, what have you gotten from this Hinduism? How are you being treated? And convert them in great numbers to Islam. So suddenly you had in India two religions. And then when the British came, following a colonial policy of divide and conquer, why is the computer doing this? There's no phone book entry anywhere. What are you talking about? This is something weird with this. So that then, because of that, they've set Hindus and then Muslims against each other, which ultimately resulted in the creation of two separate countries, India and Pakistan. All because of the hereditary caste system. That's a very heavy lecture in India. And Prabhupada did it. What he blamed it on. After many, many births, again we're describing Bhardvarsha, how the caste system can work there very nicely. the Varnashram system. After many, many births, when the results of one's pious activities mature, one gets an opportunity to associate with pure devotees. Then one is able to cut the knot of bondage to ignorance, which binds him because of varied fruitive activities. As a result of associating with devotees, one gradually renders service to Lord Vasudeva, who is transcendental, free from attachment to the material world, beyond the mind and words, and independent of everything else. That bhakti yoga, devotional service to Lord Vasudeva, is the real path of liberation.
Makes sense.
Well, you notice when the devotees come into it, although Prabhupada puts them, it's right here at the very end. It's very Mahapurusha Purusha Prasanga. Mahapurusha, the personality of Godhead, Purusha, the devotees, Prasanga, intimate relationship. So that you, by the Purusha, who are the devotees, the people who are devotees, you get to the Mahapurusha. That's just in those words. Mahapurusha, Purusha, Prasanga. That's the means of avidya granti randala, cutting the knot of ignorance. Then, after this description of Bhartvarsha, you get this Ekad Evahi Deva Gayanti. This, in fact, is what all the devas, what they chant. And first Narada, he chanted, and then after this discussion of Bhartvarsha, we now find the devas is what they chant. These are very interesting prayers for the devas. Every time you like to think that maybe the heavenly planets are nice, we should remember that the devas are coming. And regretting being there, rather be here. Since the human form of life is the sublime position for spiritual realization, Prabhupada puts that in, all the demigods in heaven speak in this way. How wonderful it is for these human beings to have been born in the land of Bhartvarsha. They must have executed pious acts of austerity in the past, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself must have been pleased with him. Otherwise, how could they engage in devotional service in so many ways? We demigods can only aspire to achieve human birth in Bhartvarsha to execute devotional service, but these human beings are already engaged there. So this is their theme, And then, of course, here, Prabhupada very much taking it now as Bhartvarsha being India, how the facilities are there in Bhartvarsha for executing devotional service. The acharyas contributed their experience. This little pesky notice, I don't know what that is, but it pops up at the contributed their experience, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally appeared to teach the people of Bhartvarsha how to progress in spiritual life and be fixed in devotional service to the Lord. From all points of view, Bhartvarsha is the special land but one can very easily understand the process of devotional service and adopt it to make his life successful. If one makes his life successful in devotional service, then preaches devotional service in other parts of the world. People throughout the world will be actually benefited. So Prabhupada has his points to make here.
Of course, Parabharsha means particularly Indians.
Yeah, right here, they're just taking it that way. Right?
Then where are the other parts of the world?
Good question. Good question. No, because if I can find the text, let me just look around a bit. But Prabhupada says about Varsha, formerly the world, now India, one place. I've got these lined up here.
And all those rivers are all.
Those are all Indian rivers,
yeah.
And those are all some of the quotation. Let me find the others just a second.
I heard it before. It's called Bharata Varsha. It was called Dvavrata Varsha.
Yeah. In this chapter, in the verse, the Ajanaba is that name is used for Bharata Varsha. Well, I don't know where Prabhupada says somewhere Ilavrita Varsha, but the former name according to Bhagavatam is Ajanaba Varsha. I can't really find these places where he, but here did you? That's why it's popping up. I got some stuff left over from the internet. Just some places where Prabhupada says things that make you think of that he's. Here in the synonyms of 5921, Jambudvip Varshani, different parts of Jambudvip, parentheses, probably Asia and Europe combined together. Prabhupada. This is Prabhupada's thing. Then he mentions the mountains, the southern mountains. They mark the boundaries of the three Varshas named Hari Varsha, Kimbaroop Varsha, and Bard Varsha, India. Then there's this other interesting, of the three divisions of heavenly planets, Swargaloka, Boma Swarga is sometimes accepted as the tract of land in Bard Varsha known as Kashmir. And then here's a little discussion in Tehran. Prabhupada, formerly from Kashmir to Central Asia, it was known as Bhusvarga, especially Kashmir. Bhusvarga. So there it's even bigger. Dayananda, heaven on earth. Prabhupada, yes, heaven on the earthly planet. So here he says formerly, you know. Now there's some other interesting things I've collected here in this thing just to show you. So here's, they're having a discussion. At the end of a class. The class is in Los Angeles in 74. Prajuna's reading. But Rashva, we know but Rashva, is an island near Meru Parvata, is what Prabhupada wrote. There's a description of this island in the Mahabharata Bhishma Parva. The description was narrated by Sanjaya to Dhritarashtra Maharaj. Yudhisthira also conquered this island. and thus the province was included within the jurisdiction of his empire. So that's in the Mahabharata, that that place was conquered by Yudhishthira. Maharaj Prichit was formally declared to be emperor of all the lands ruled by his grandfather, but still he had to establish supremacy. Prabhupada then interrupts, the islands, this island might have changed the name, but there are so many islands. And just like this, maybe Java and the island, Lakshadweep Island, very small islands. Similarly, this Meru is another island. Here he's calling them Varshas, they're calling them islands. Not only these small islands, but according to Vedic culture, each planet is called island. Each planet, just like this planet, earthly planet, is called Jambudvipa. Now here he's calling it Jambudvipa. Why is it called Dweep? Dweep means island, because actually it is an island in the air. Just like there are so many islands in the sea, similarly this vast air, outer space, all these planets are floating like island. Therefore they're called island. Dweepa, Jambudvipa. I remember there was a movie when I was a kid, This Island Earth or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Then he says, listen to this, here in this earthly planet, long, long ago, it is said in the Vedic literature, Saptadvipa. Now that usually refers to the ring islands of Bhumandala. There's seven of them, right? Sapta means seven. So this earthly planet is of seven dvipas, seven islands. These two Americas, north and south, they are islands. Africa, one island. And combined Asia and Europe, another island. The two poles, two islands. Australia, another island. You see, Saptadvipa. So they say they discovered America, but this discovery was long, long, many, many millions of years it was known. Where is the discovery? Their poor fund of knowledge. So here, the Saptadvipa, he's thinking it's referring to the continent on Earth. Then in Majjalila, writing in the commentary, within this universe, we've read this before actually, Mahaprabhu was explaining the different manifestations of the Lord, and he mentions these are situated on seven islands in nine sections, khandas. And then Prabhupada mentions the seven islands are mentioned in the Siddhanta Shiromani. These seven islands, and he gives the names of the seven islands of Bhumandala. Jambu, Shaka, Shamali, Kusha, Kramsha, Gomeda. Gomeda is a different name, Plaksha and Pushkara. They're in a different order. The planets are called Dvipas. Outer space is like an ocean of air. So he didn't just say it, he wrote it. Just as there are islands in the watery ocean, these planets are in the ocean of space, are called dvipas or islands in outer space. So he mentions that here also. So there are reasons for this idea that at least Sataputta is advocating, that the description of the universe according to the fifth canto is one kind of map that has a number of different applications in different contexts. And so Prabhupada sometimes he talks like that. I mean, it's not just a concoction on the part of Sataputta. There's reasons for thinking like that. And then we read this here. Right, these places. So I just think, so in different contexts he talks like this. So the other parts of the world, yeah. Then the demigods continue. After performing the very difficult tasks of executing Vedic ritualistic sacrifices, undergoing austerities, observing vows, and giving charity, we have achieved this position, as inhabitants of the heavenly planets. But what is the value of this achievement? Here we are, certainly very engaged in material sense gratification, and therefore we can hardly remember the lotus feet of Lord Narayana. Indeed, because of our excessive sense gratification, we have almost forgotten his lotus feet. So this is now they did all these things and they've achieved the heavenly planets, but it's Phalguna, very insignificant. And the remembrance of Narayana Padapankaja, the lotus feet of Lord Narayana, is lost because of excessive, they call Indriya Utsava. Utsava, having a festival of the senses, you could say. Enthusiasm for sex gratification. Indriya Utsava.
Wasn't it to mention that those heavenly areas, the difference between them, Jhana and Anjana, that they still remember the Lord, even if they have so much sense in them, and you can bomb?
Yeah, they have more sense in German, right.
But here it says, they forget.
Yeah, well, here this is their own estimation.
Oh.
So apparently they have this capacity, but still, the fact is, you know, that people do not, as a rule, in the heavenly planets, make further spiritual advancement. We notice everywhere that if people are too, and just in our own little sphere, if people are really too rich and too nice and too well set up and comfortable, they tend not to be candidates for spiritual life. And if people are really, really poor, really, really degraded, really, really also, because you're so busy trying to stay alive that you can't even think of it. So it's some of the middle regions are the better ones. So Earth is like that. So at least the human form of life, you're not necessarily suffering so much that you can't even get beyond it. But on the other hand, you're not that happy. So it's just better. Very few people are like Buddha. You know the story they tell about Buddha, Prince Sakyamuni, that Prince Siddhartha of the Sakyamuni clan. He was there was a prediction that he would become a renounced and a great spiritual leader, and so his family tried to prevent that from happening by making sure they had the understanding that the king's lead to spiritual life is people have bad experiences in this world, so they want to make sure that everything was nice. So he was pretty much cloistered off into a palace, and they just made sure he never underwent anything unpleasant. And they made sure that every person he saw was good looking and beautiful and young, and everything was just nice all the time. There was nothing bad. But still, he got curious about what was outside the palace, and he went out one day, or went out in a sequence of days, depending who's telling the stories. And the first thing he did is he saw an old person, and he was just horrified. What happened to that man? He's just an old guy, you know, it's just natural. And then he saw somebody diseased, you know, somebody with tuberculosis or something. And then finally saw a corpse. And that's all it took, were those three things. And he left. He just figured it all just from looking at those three things. Most people don't take more than that. You've got to understand the nature of the material world. So yeah, this is their own estimation, that they're not as devoted as the people on Bharatvarsha. Yeah. They've lost their remembrance. So Prabhupada says, Bhargavas is so exalted that by taking birth there, one can not only attain the heavenly plans, but also go directly back home, back to Godhead. I've heard people say that. I've heard that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said it, but Prabhupada never mentioned that. I've never seen him mention it anywhere. Now maybe this is because he's preaching and everybody knows there's only, I don't know, but he just never said it. So I don't know anything about it. I can't explain it. Is that a problem? Prabhupada said, they asked Prabhupada once, when it says the spiritual master knows everything, what does that mean? He says, he knows everything his spiritual master has taught him. So, but I know there's statements like that. But and I don't say they're wrong, but I just don't know anything about it.
I couldn't hear anything.
The statement that the Buddha that we talk about in history is not the Buddha that's mentioned in the scriptures. The one that's the one in the Dasha Avatar Stotram is an incarnation of Krishna. This is not this Buddha. That's what they're saying. So here Prabhupada says, therefore the demigods even regret having been elevated to the higher planetary systems. The denizens of the heavenly planets regret that they could not take full advantage of being born in the land of Bhargavarsha. Instead, they became captivated by a higher standard of sense gratification, and therefore they forgot the lotus feet of Lord Narayana at the time of death. In other words, Prabhupada's understanding of this is that they were in Bhargavarsha. They lost the opportunity to go back home. They became captivated and therefore went to the heavenly planets. And now they know their further spiritual advancement, although they're remembering the Lord and all these things like that, their further spiritual advancement is on hold until they come back down again. So those that are really, really interested in spiritual advancement, they're waiting to be promoted to Bhargavarsha.
I think Prabhupada once complained about that some of my disciples that don't want to go back to Godhead, they're just hoping to get
some. I think more than some. If you know, when you read the description that you remember God, you practice devotional service, and at the same time you get really heavy sense gratification, and it's not simple. I know a lot of people. That's what they really want.
Yeah. They're not trying to go back to Godhead.
Yeah, they really, think the ideal life is. Yeah, they think the ideal life is a high level of high sense gratification. Sure.
Well, I just had a conversation with a devotee in Australia 2 days ago. He's been on dialysis for 14 years, and it's just become too much for him. So he's made a decision he's going to just stop the treatment.
Uh-huh.
So I rang him up and I asked him, what does that mean? And he said, well, it means you'll be dead within 1 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a nice talk. And then at one point he said, I'm just hoping that, you know, somewhere or another I can take birth in a devotee family and like that. I told him, I said, that's so bogus. I said, you know, Prabhupada didn't come to tell us to take him with the food. You know, he told us to go back up there to Godhead, so that's where you've got to fix your mind on. way you to hold the altar Krishna. But you know, if you make a good determination, you want to take another birth. But if you seriously want to go through all this stuff again, and, oh, he hadn't thought about it, you know. And a lot of the devotees are like that. They really don't feel that they're fit to go back to Godhead. So they don't think that they should even think about it.
Oh yeah, you know. This gets clear that that's what should be our aim. If we don't make it, okay. But if you start thinking, well, at least I want this or want that, then you're. And sometimes that is, even if you think I'm doing it because I'm just not fit and you're feeling humble, really, it may be the cover for some desire to enjoy this material world. Even I heard one devotee say to Prabhupada, I just want to take birth again so I can push on the Sankirtan movement, and Prabhupada rebuked him for that. No, you should want to go back home, back to Godhead. Because people also think that somehow that's like selfish. But you should want to be qualified to go back home, back to Godhead. What Krishna does with me, that's his own business. It shouldn't be any concern of mine, but that should be my aim. Because sometimes the desires for material enjoyment are kind of, they're very subtle. And we can be harboring them like computer viruses or something. and not know them until they can come out at the last minute. And remember, not only do we have to get over the temptations of sin, we have to get over the temptations of piety. That's another anartha, the desire to enjoy the results of pious activities. But that's not a problem. So Prabhupada here, he says, one should try to return back home, back to Godhead, to the Vaikuntha planets. Now they amplify the statement, just if we're not true. A short life in the land of Bhart Varsha is preferable. Or you say an ISKCON preferable, but the actual... It's preferable. A short life in the land of Bhart Varsha is preferable to a life achieved in Brahmaloka for millions and billions of years, because even if one is elevated to Brahmaloka, he must return to this repeated birth and death. Abrahma Mupanal Loka, you come back. Although life in Bhart Varsha in a lower planetary system is very short, one who lives there can elevate himself to full Krishna consciousness and achieve the highest perfection even in this short life by fully surrendering unto the lotus feet of the Lord. Thus one attains Vaikuntha Loka, where there is neither anxiety or repeated birth in a material body. So it said, Kalpa Ayusham, one whose lifetime is measured in kalpas. But again, Puna comes back down. So there's the Kalpa Ayusha, you see up here at the beginning, Kalpa Ayusha, and then down here, Shana Ayusham, the meager lifetime. That's more valuable. And Prabhupada again repeats, he keeps repeating this statement, and CC Bharata Bhumate Vali Manusha Janma Sataka Kari Karapara Upakar. This is very easy, even for a child. Why not take this path? This is the best opportunity offered to the inhabitants of Bharatvarsha. That is, go directly to Krishna and engage in his service. So the devas continued. An intelligent person does not take interest in a place, even the topmost planetary system, if the pure Ganges of topics concerning the Supreme Lord's activities do not flow there, if there are not devotees engaged in such service on the banks of such a river of piety, or if there are no festivals of Sankirtan Yajna to satisfy the Lord, brackets, especially since Sankirtan Yajna is recommended in this age. There is a nice verse. Nayatra Vaikuntha Gata Sudapada. Where there is no Vaikuntha Gata Sudapaga, like the Apagas river, he calls it a Ganges in the translation. Pure river of Vaikuntha Gata, Krishna Gata. See, the word Vaikuntha not only is a place, but it also means the Lord of that place. So the Lord is just Vaikuntha. Nor Sanava Bhagavatas Tadashraya, nor devotees who are always take shelter of the Supreme Personality God, Godhead, nor Yajna Maka, Yajna Isha Maka, Mahotsava, where there are festivals of sacrifice, such a place. Suresh Lokapi Navai Sa Sevyatam. This is a better place to be than where there's Suresh Loka. So here, this is a nice verse. So here again, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in the land of Bhagavarsha, specifically in Bengal, in the district of Nadia, where Navadvip is situated. It is therefore to be concluded, as stated by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that within this universe, this earth planet is the best, and on this planet earth, Bhagavarsha is the best. Strong distinction there. In the land of Bhagavarsha, Bengal is still better. In the Bengal, the district of Nadia is still better, and in Nadia, the best place is Navadvip, because Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared there to inaugurate the performance of the sacrifice of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Therefore, this is the best among all places in the universe. This Krishna conscious movement has established its center in Mayapur. Are we fortunate? Here we are, huh? The birth site of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, given me the great opportunity to go there and perform a constant festival of Sankirtan Yajna, as recommended here, Yajne Shivaka Mahotsava, to distribute prasadam to millions of hungry people hankering for spiritual emancipation. This is the mission of the Krishna consciousness movement. And then he quotes this Chaitanya Bhagavat. One should not desire to be elevated even to a place in the heavenly planetary system if it has no propaganda to expand the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, no trace of Vaishnavas, pure devotees of the Lord, and no festivals for spreading Krishna consciousness. It would be better to live perpetually cramped within the airtight bag of a mother's womb, where one can at least remember the lotus feet of the Lord, than to live in a place where there's no opportunity to remember his lotus feet. I pray not to be allowed to take birth in such a condemned place. And the Prabhupada takes this opportunity for the glorification of Sankirtan Yajna. And so it's a nice Bhagavarsha offers the proper land and circumstances in which to execute devotional services can free one from the results of jnana and karma. If one attains a human body in the land of Bharatvarsha with clear sensory organs which wish to escape the Sankirtan Yasana. Now Prabhupada is just like, it's just the verses are just, you know, talking about Yasana and so on. But Prabhupada wants to bring it home to us. You know? But in spite of this opportunity, he does not take to devotional service. He's certainly like a liberated forest animal. And birds that are careless and therefore again bound by the hunter. So you've got this verse with provided with, see that this trilogy is here, Jnana, Kriya and Drovya. That is all the things you need for sacrifice. Knowledge how to do it, the activities to do it, all the ingredients, the senses, and you don't do it. So you're just apuna bhava, which means taking birth there. Puna bhava, apuna, not taking birth again, you lose that opportunity. So again, Prabhupada glorifies Navadvip and Vrindavan, and he says, taking advantage of all the facilities offered him, he says, animals and birds also have freedom, but because of their lower birth, they cannot use it. Taking advantage of all the facilities offered him, a human being who has taken birth in the land of Bharatvarsha should become a fully enlightened devotee and go back home, back to Godhead. This is the subject matter of the Krishna consciousness movement. The inhabitants of places other than Bharatvarsha have facility for material enjoyment, but they do not have the same facility to take to Krishna consciousness. And again, he cites Mahaprabhu's statement. Next text, the devas in Bharatvarsha, in India, there are many worshippers of the demigods, the various officials appointed by the Supreme Lord, such as Indra, Chandra, and Surya, all of whom are worshipped differently. The worship of the demigods offer the demigods their oblations. Considering the demigods parts and parcel of the whole of the Supreme Lord, therefore the Supreme Personality of Godhead accepts these offerings and gradually raises the worshippers to the real standard of devotional service by fulfilling their desires and aspirations. Because the Lord is complete, he offers the worshippers the benedictions they desire, even if they worship only a part of his transcendental body. Of course, Prabhupada, speaking from the Bhagavad Gita, he talks about how Krishna would prefer you to worship him directly. Supreme Personality of Godhead fulfills the material desires of a devotee who approaches him with such motives. But this is a verse that we hear a lot. But he does not bestow benedictions upon the devotee that will cause him to demand more benedictions again. However, the Lord willingly gives the devotee shelter at his own lotus feet, even though such a person does not aspire for it, and that shelter satisfies his desires. This is the Supreme Personality's special mercy. This verse is discussed a bit in Chaitanya Charitamrita. I think maybe it's in the purport. Satyam dishanti yarhitam artito rinam naivartito yat punar artita yata Swayam vidate bhajatam manishchitam chapidanam japada palavam. So certainly, satyam, for sure, he gets what he wants, but that the Lord himself does not give something that will make the person seek to come back again and again. But he gives the devotee shelter to his own lotus feet, even though a person doesn't aspire for it. Let me see, where is it? Okay, here we go. This is it, your prophet. Yeah, I'll just go to this. So then, if those who desire material enjoyment emerge into existence of the Absolute Truth, engage in the Lord's transcendental service, they will immediately attain shelter at Krishna's lotus feet, although they do not ask for it. Krishna is very merciful. Krishna says, this is easier to remember than the verse. This is like just expanding on the verse. If one engages in my transcendental living service, but at the same time wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he's very, very foolish. And yet, indeed, he's just like a person who gives up ambrosia, meaning amrita, to drink poison. In Greek stories of the gods, they drink ambrosia, amrita, keeps them young. Since I am very intelligent, this is Krishna speaking, since I am very intelligent, why should I give this fool material prosperity? Instead, I shall induce him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material enjoyment. And then they quote this verse here, Chaitanya Charita. Satam dishantyartita martito ninam. So here's another translation of the same verse. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so, but he does not award anything which, after being enjoyed, will cause one to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. When one has other desires but engages in the Lord's service, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where he will forget all other desires. So this is where this comes from. This is from those prayers of the devatas, glorifying what happens in Bhargavarsha, why it's so good. When someone engages in Lord Krishna's devotional service for the satisfaction of the senses and instead acquires a taste for serving Krishna, he gives up his material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. So that's what they're saying here. And here Prabhupada is translating these verses from the CC. Well, here it is, the next verse where the Ajanaba. There it is, that's the name. The name before it was Bhargavarsha was Ajanaba. So here it's used, just without unceremoniously in this verse. Yada Atunda Swaga Sukha Vashishitam. Tena Janade. I looked it up, I couldn't find it. The person was Nabhi, the son of Agnitra, but somehow or other it wasn't named Nabhi, it was named Ajanaba. Why, I don't know. We are now living in the heavenly planets. And undoubtedly, as a result of our having performed ritualistic ceremonies, pious activities, and yajnas, and having studied the Vedas, however, our lives here will one day be finished. We pray at that time, if any merit remains from our pious activities, we may again take birth in Bhartvarsha as human beings, able to remember the lotus feet of the Lord. The Lord is so kind that He personally comes to the land of Bhartvarsha and expands the good fortune of its people. Sham Dhanoti. So they're praying again. They come here. So, if Prabhupada's conclusion,
huh? His last line seems to indicate none of the prayers in the other version said he personally comes. Here it says the Lord, he personally comes to teach to us.
Yeah, most places he comes here all the time. The other, remember, they're a deity form, but he comes here first. And the deities they're worshipping are all deities that tended to show up in Bhartvarsha.
Doesn't mean that he never goes there?
Huh?
Why the deity form? Doesn't mean that he never goes there?
Doesn't mean what?
Krishna is following, always coming to Bhartvarsha. But other
places,
his deity forms are there.
Yeah.
Is it saying that he never goes to other planets just in this
kind? I think it's not true that he. But he appears in other planets. We see him coming. But very brief. But when he comes down and does extensive leela, it tends to be in Bhartvarsha. But you can think where it all takes place. Where did the Sringadeva appear? Yeah. It seemed to me that he was sitting on the throne of Indra, right? But on the other hand, there's a place in India where they say this is the throne, this is where, you know, so I don't know.
We had a discussion with Prabhupada about that.
Yeah.
And he said, well, the verse that glorifies Lord Vishnu, that he says that he's being there with everyone.
But anyway, it seems that Bhartvarsha is a focus of attention by the Lord. Just let me read this verse. Yeah, go ahead.
I remember Srila Maharaj, of course, he was in the air, and alchemist of Srila Maharaj. And there was a shot of him speaking with one of the acharyas in Hogland, or close to Hogland. They were speaking about this issue whether this throne was really in Hogland, in India, but so many different temples, or was it in heavenly planets, and it was important. And then Lama Guru was like a vacation, you know, you might be ruling from the heavenly planet, but you might be on vacation.
I mean, the Sringadeva apparently stopped off nearby here, huh? In the Sringapali, right? On the way back from killing the Sringadeva. It sounds like it happened here, you know, I mean, I don't know. Anyway. So Prabhupada says here, this is a kind of interesting what he says. Even the demigods must return to earth to work like ordinary men when the results of their pious activities expire. Nevertheless, the demigods desire to come to the land of Bhartvarsha even if a small portion of the merits of their pious activities remains. In other words, to take birth in Bhartvarsha, one must perform more pious activities than the demigods. In Bhartvarsha, one is naturally Krishna conscious. Must be in India, huh? At least every place except Bombay. And if one further cultivates his Krishna consciousness by the grace of Krishna, he certainly expands his good fortune and becomes perfect in Krishna consciousness and very easily going back home, back to Godhead. In many other places in the Vedic literature, it is found that even the demigods want to come to this land of Bharatvarsha. And he quotes it again. The Krishna consciousness movement is therefore spreading this facility to human society by opening many centers all over the world so that people may associate with the pure devotees of the Krishna consciousness movement, understand Krishna consciousness, and ultimately go back home, back to Godhead. So that's the end of their prayers, of the demigods. But they, in their glorification of Bhagavarsha, that's certainly an impressive, we should feel better about the opportunity and encourage to use it if the devotees want to come here. So now Shukadeva Goswami, he continues to speak. Back to the geography lesson. In the opinion of some learned scholars, 8 smaller islands surround Jambudvip. When the sons of Maharaj Sudara were searching all over the world for their lost horse, they dug up the earth, and in this way 8 adjoining islands came into existence. And then the names are there, none of which I could really find except in the dictionary, except Simbala and Lanka have both been used as names for Ceylon, the offshore island.
And the people in Sri Lanka are similar.
So I don't know what these islands are, or where they are, or anything like that. But it sort of says the word that's used for these, for them, I'm thinking of adjoining islands as offshore islands. The Sanskrit word is where is Upadvipa? 8 Upadvipas. Subordinate islands or smaller islands or something like that. Around, on Jambudvip, so I assume they were around Jambudvip. But.
And that means like possibly in the salt ocean?
Yeah, I assume it's in the salt ocean. But I don't know anything more about this. In the purport, Prabhupada goes back to talking about the he mentions in Vedic literature it said, he puts it in the purport to this verse. Although that you're quoting from the Kurva Purana, although the demigods are situated in exalted positions in the heavenly planets, they nevertheless desire to descend to the land of Bhartvarsha, Svargastha Bharatodbhavam, on the planet Earth. This indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Bhartvarsha. Therefore, if persons already born in Bhartvarsha lives like cats and dogs, not taking full advantage of their birth in this land, they are certainly unfortunate. So Prabhupada doesn't seem to be that interested in the islands. So he says that, and then finally, I think this is the conclusion here. Yeah. My dear King Parikshit, O best of the descendants of Bharat Maharaj, I have thus described to you, as I myself have been instructed, Yata Upadesham, the islands of Bharat Varsha and its adjoining islands. These are the islands that constitute Jambudvip. That's the end of that chapter about Jambudvip. Any questions about this, huh?
Maybe the adjoining islands of America.
I heard that somebody who's been studying this is finding many. If I understood correctly, this thing about the adjoining islands, they're making something big of it, or finding something big about it, or something. Another interpretation, but I don't know about that. We'll see if it shows up again. these different islands.
Who's Maharaj Sagar?
Well, it's a story. Anybody remember the Maharaj Sagar story? He, I forgot now. I think it's in the Bhagavatam. Yeah, maybe ten. Oh no, his name is mentioned there. That's what. Where is it? Ganga Sagara, yeah, okay. The Ashru Sagara.
Sagara,
the ocean. It's a Maharaj Sagara. Yeah, the sons of Sagara. Yeah, they meet Lord Kapila. Okay, let's see what we find here about this one. Yeah, okay, here it is. Well, there's a whole story here. Let's get past the Bhagats here. When Boka died in the forest, his wife wanted to accept the principle of Sati, dying with her husband, but when she was about to die, a sage named Aurava found that she was pregnant and forbade her to do so. The co-wives of this wife of Boka gave her poison with their food, but still her son was born with the poison. The son was therefore named Sagara, Sa meaning with, and Gara meaning poison. Following the instructions of the great sage Aurava, King Sagara reformed many clans, including the Yavanas, Shakas, Haihayas, and Barbaras. Wow, no kidding.
Barbarians.
Yeah, well, that's the Greek word. And for those people, when they speak, it sounds like bar, 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 bar. They're barbarian. That's the explanation I heard anyway. Barbaros. The king did not kill them, but reformed them. Then again, following the instructions of Arva, King Sagar performed Ashramedha sacrifices. But the horse needed for such a sacrifice was stolen by Indra, the king of heaven. He was always afraid people would beat him in the sacrifice contest of one-upmanship. King Sagara had two wives named Sumati and Keshini. While searching for the horse, the sons of Sumati extensively dug up the surface of the earth and in this way dug a trench which later became known as the Sagara Ocean. In the course of this search, they came upon the great personality Kapila Dev and thought him to have stolen the horse. Those guys, you know? It's so typical. With this offensive understanding, they attacked him and were all burnt to ashes. Keshini, the second wife of King Sagara, had a son named Asamanjasa, whose son Amshuman later searched for the horse and delivered his uncles. Upon approaching Kapila, Amshuman saw both the horse meant for sacrifice and a pile of ashes. His uncles. Amshuman offered prayers to Kapila Dev, who was very pleased by his prayers and who returned the horse. After getting back the horse, however, Amshuman still stood before Kapila Dev, and Kapila could understand that Amshuman was praying for the deliverance of his forefathers. Thus Kapila Dev offered, this is the whole story, now I have the Ganga Sagara, you know. Yeah. The Kapila offered this instruction they could be delivered by the waters from the Ganges. And so let's find out where they're digging up the earth. The sons of Sumati, who are very proud of their prowess and influence, followed the orders of their father in searching for the lost horse. While doing so, they dug up the earth extensively. Thereafter, in the northeast direction, it doesn't mention here that they digged this ditch. Prabhupada may have been providing it there. So they approached the sage and they thought he was a thief, and He opened his eyes. By the influence of Indra, the king of heaven, the sons of Sagar lost their intelligence. Oh. Consequently, fire emanated from their own bodies, but they self-ignited.
Well, from his glands.
Yeah, but still, I mean, they killed by the fire of their own bodies. Whoa. It is sometimes argued that the son of King Sagara were burnt to ashes by the fire emanating from the eyes of Kapila Muni. This statement is not approved by great learned persons, for Kapila Muni's body is completely in the mode of goodness and therefore cannot manifest the mode of ignorance in the form of anger. Just as the pure sky cannot be polluted by dust of the earth. And so they're talking about he was just never resentful. Now, where's the thing about the trench? They're not in here. Huh? The Sagara Ocean. No, we'll get a little back, okay. About the boy, the. Anyway. Yeah. So there must be some stories elsewhere in other literatures about the trenches they're digging up and everything. There's so much research to be done, you know, to follow up on this. I think I looked at this and didn't find anything about geography, just another great story that makes you Krishna conscious, so I skipped it.
Could you? Let me clarify something that was mentioned yesterday.
Yeah?
If you go to Majjha 10 in your database, verse 230, there from Krishna Das Kaviraj describing what son of Mama saw with the little
Yeah.
And it says that he saw the form of Vishnu from the Ishvara Murti and then the form of Krishna. That's what I said yesterday. He doesn't mention Sadhguru.
Where'd you see it?
It was in a letter. It's in
a purple.
It's in a purple.
Prabhupada discusses Sarvabhauma in the branches of the tree. Yeah. And those are usually like condensed by the tree.
Yeah.
So he says, yeah, he saw the form of Sadhguru.
Yeah, but it doesn't say there. Well, it could be that other people understood. I don't know what's in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. I think rather than try to start the next chapter, I'll just give you a little preview of coming attractions. Tomorrow we have off for Nityananda's appearance day. And then, by then I'll give you a handout, so we can do the whole chapter, you know, get through this chapter, because it's a description, one after the other, of the features of Bhumandala, starting with the saltwater ocean, and then the ring islands and the saltwater oceans. On each ring island, it describes the sun, just like Anidra was the son of Priyavrata, who got Jambudvip and then divided up among his sons. Similarly, on all these annular islands, there's another son, all of whom have names of Agni, who is given that island. All except one have seven sons. They're divided into seven varshas. The varshas are named after the sun, so we get the names of the sons, and with the same thing, the name of the varshas. We get there's four varnas, corresponding to Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, and Shudras. They each have a different set of names for each Varsha, and those names are given. There's seven boundary mountains, the boundaries are named. There's seven great rivers, and the great rivers are named. And so this is the pattern. Although they're each one also has an inch, just like there's the jambu tree. of which Jambudvipa is named after, and so on. Each one of these, there's a special feature that gives the place its name. A certain kind of tree. The first one out is Pluksha tree, and Pluksha is a kind of fig tree. And so every one, as you go out, there's a special feature. All of them are plants, except for the last island, which is called Pushkaradweep. And instead of being divided in sections, in seven, it has a medial concentric Manasotra mountain on it. And so, and this one had two suns. So one gets the inner version, the other gets the outer version. Otherwise, so that's all described. Each of them also worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead under the name of, or they worship a demigod as the manifestation or representative of the Supreme Lord. The verses make this clear. It's not like simple demigod worship, but sort of like that. And so they each have a mantra, and the mantra is given. And other unusual features are mentioned passing by. When we get to Manasotra Mountain, we talk about what goes on the top of that mountain. And then after you get past the rings, after you get the last ocean, is a ocean of sweet water. And then there's a place called Loka, which is just inhabited land. And Kanchanabhumi, which is land which has a surface of burnished gold, which is so bright that if you drop anything on it, it disappears. So whoever lived there left a long time ago. Then there's the wonderful Loka Mountain, which goes way up past Dhruvaloka, and with the mountain, the balancing elephants on the top. And then past that is Aloka, all the way out to the edge of the universe, or close to the edge of the universe. That's what's in that chapter. And so we'll go through that in a fast way. I'll see how much handout material I can give to you, because a lot of it's, we're not going to learn the names. But I started translating some of these names, you know. They're really interesting. That's the next chapter. So you go all the way out now to.
That's all Bhumandala.
Yeah, that's all. Bhumandala. Mm-hmm. Then after that, you start to go up, and then after that, you go down.
Just one comment. I remember in so-called Asian folk stories, many times a story would start like this. I don't know, it's number 7 or number 9 mentioned. That once upon a time, behind the 7 hills and 7 rivers, there was a king.
Yeah.
And then the story is far out, but after you have this knowledge, yeah, it doesn't seem so far out at all.
This is where all stories begin. Sariputta points out, like a lot of old stories, you can trace them back. You know, the fact is that 800 miles above the earth, 100 yards is where the Rakshasas live. So there's a story we all learned in America about Jack and the Beanstalk. How he planted this bean seed and this big vine came up, and he climbed up and pat over the clouds, and there was a giant, and right? So it's so many of these stories. One poem that I like very much, it's in German by this poet Novalis, has this talking about a future time when he says when numbers and figures are no longer seen as the key to all creatures, to understand all creatures, and when those people who have learned the way to sing and to embrace are more deeply learned than even the biggest scholar. And when the world returns to a free life and comes back to its own true self, and when light and darkness are remarried or reunited to produce a finer clarity. And then there's the line, Unman immersion ungedichten erkennt die wahre Weltgeschichte. And people are able to recognize immersion in, you know, old fairy stories, you know, folk tales, and old poetry, the true history of the world. And then, this is the last line. Then it says, und dann vor einer geheimen Wort, den Fried vor einer geheimen Wort, das ganze Verkehr der Wesen fort. And then, when a single secret word is uttered, this whole perverted existence runs away. Sounds to me like a prophecy. The Krishna consciousness movement. It's got this line, and people see, are able finally to see in these ancient tales and old rhymes, you know, the world's true histories. So that day will come. Huh? Right now this is all Jack and the Beanstalk and Esvarai Mal and Kurnik. There was once upon a time there was a king. But there are all, these are all the original stories, so it will happen, I guarantee it. Novalis was right.
When did he write?
Huh? Just at the term between the 17th and at the beginning of the 19th century, from the 18th to 19th century. He didn't live very long. But a very early romantic counter-enlightenment kind of a person. He was a mining engineer, so he really knew about numbers and figures. But he was quite a figure. Yeah, didn't live very long.
What do you mean when you say numbers and animals? He called it.
Right now, in this case, he foresaw what was happening. He said when numbers and formulas or figures or diagrams are no longer the key to understand all beings. So in other words, this is definitely the scientific enterprise. You try to understand everything that exists in terms of numbers. And that's supposed to tell you everything that there is. That's the scientific enlightenment project. So he said, well, that's no longer an operative anymore. That's the first thing he said.
Because what had just happened in
the 18th century was the so-called Enlightenment. Aufklärung in German, which was really was just the opposite of the Enlightenment. But at that time, in two places it really started. One was France, and the other was England, Scotland. And there was this kind of intellectual revolution that everything from the past is bad. That, you know, it was inspired really by Newton. Because in some ways, Newton, you know, when he came up with these rational little laws, it looked like all of nature could simply be described, you know, he had these formulas. And by these formulas, suddenly, you know, it looked like all of nature was working according to laws. And they really very quickly came to the idea that the universe was like a clock. You know, that was the cutting-edge technology in those days. Just like everything's like a computer, you know. So their clock was that kind. That was the cutting-edge technology. And so the universe was like a clock. It was just everything worked together with mathematical precision. A clock is something you could describe completely in terms of numbers. Yeah. And that's what the universe was. And so people... Even if they believed in God, they were called deists. In the sense that, yes, God made the clock. He wound it up. But because it's such a good clock, it's hands off. He just walks away. So there's a God, but he really doesn't have anything to do. Miracles? Come on, that's you know, in a clock, you don't want to mess with a clock. It's working. And also, the universe became a very deterministic universe. So they saw like this success from Newton. They extrapolated, saying like, yeah, everywhere in nature is rational, organized, describable in terms of numbers like a clock. The only thing that's really messy is human society, which is full of superstition and other things. And now we have to apply this to human society. And we have to get rid of all the garbage. We have to get rid of kings. We have to get rid of priests. Everything from the past was just this wholesale rejection. Let's just throw it out and start over again. And so this was the experiment of the Enlightenment. But almost immediately there was something that historians call the Counter-Enlightenment. People didn't like it. And wanted to somehow... So you see right away people wanting to go back and discuss... Just like Ken Novalis is a typical person of... He knew the Enlightenment. He was a trained mining engineer. He was educated in this way of thinking. But he hated it. It killed the human spirit. Like Wordsworth, you know, we murder to dissect. And that in feeling and spontaneity and so on, this is where real truth will lie. And that in the old stories and the old traditions, there's hidden truths there. So you have these two things going on, and they still exist. I mean, the Counter-Enlightenment kind of flourished and turned into what was called Romanticism. European Romanticism as a literary and philosophical movement. The emphasis on holism, on organic unity.
New Age movement.
Yeah, it's still going on. Like when the hippie movement started, it was just, it's tapping into the same stream. And the Enlightenment people, they're still going on. These two things have still been moving in parallel. You know, sometimes one's on top and sometimes one of the other. And that's what's going on. So it didn't die down. You can take the counterculture of the 60s in America, and it's absolutely nothing new. You had hippies in Germany in the 19th century. Wonderful, but these guys running around taking their clothes off in the woods. In fact, there's a case that some of them went to California. And you can actually trace. So ISKCON in some way, ISKCON is very much a counter-enlightenment movement. It's not this, but you know, that's why it got its roots in those. Like, for example, I have a book by a bunch of scholars called Understanding Mantras, Scholars of Hinduism. And it's a collection of essays. And in the introduction, it says something like this. Modern scholars have a problem with studying mantras. It said, we accept the Enlightenment consensus. We do not believe in magic. Most of us do not even pray. So that we accept the Enlightenment consensus. Because mantras are somebody comes and says something and things happen. Magic, right? Spells, witchcraft. We accept the Enlightenment consensus as anything. Prabhupada does it, and we don't. Is we don't accept the Enlightenment consensus. I mean, the whole diatribe against space travel and everything is against the Enlightenment consensus.
All right.
In that, the other counter-enlightenment movements that we see now and we have in common with are these fundamentalisms. Krishna consciousness is not like these fundamentalisms, but that much is these are people who also, because people, what's happened with the enlightenment, of course, is that it develops technology, it has become a world-spanning movement, and you have this, you know, single kind of culture of modernity that is expanding, and it just gobbles up. I mean, you know, you get a traditional culture and way of life, and modernity comes, and everything turns into McDonald's and Coca-Cola, and it's all becomes homogenized in one thing. So some people are really protesting against this. They don't want it to happen. And one expression of it are these kind of fundamentalisms. This is something people didn't anticipate. I mean, all these enlightenment people, they thought by now religion would be finished. It would be over. And they're so surprised to see this happening. They just can't believe it, that this is what's going on now. Blowing their minds. But anyway, that's some of the context of Krishna consciousness. And so Prabhupada is very aggressive about this. He really wants to start a civilization that's based on completely other premises. Because Prabhupada thinks, as I think, that modernity is a mistake. I mean, there was the Enlightenment, and followed even go back to the Renaissance, that was step one, then the Enlightenment, then the Industrial Revolution, and then it produced this whole thing culture. But it's a mistake. It's an overdevelopment of the mode of passion, and it's going to burn out. And then what?
And the amount of ignorance.
Well, yeah, it could be. But the other thing that could happen is, at a certain point, people are going to look for an alternative. Right now, people have embraced science because it's giving them goodies. But as soon as they don't get goodies from science anymore, like when you get a medical treatment, when the side effects are worse than the disease. So now we have side effects like global warming and stuff like that, and just the dissolution of. I mean, you see how the family has fallen apart, how societies have fallen apart, how individuals are isolated. I mean, it's just so many of these things are just. That's the effect of modernity. To do all these things, that's the Enlightenment project. Yeah. And a lot of people don't like the brave new world, that's all. Anyway, because it's an overdevelopment of the mode of passion, Prabhupada just didn't think that this was progress that will go on forever. I mean, that's the Enlightenment vision, it's this idea of progress. And like when Bhaktivinoda Thakur was writing, you know, it had such a grip on everybody. But it got a big blow in World War I. Everybody was thinking progress, and then all of Europe was faced with this gigantic civil war which had slaughter on an inconceivable industrial scale. And people began to realize there's something wrong. But people, it's still there. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to see Ronald Reagan doing commercials for General Electric, you know, progress is our most important product. Everybody thinks it's all going to get better and better, you know. And that's why this they keep promising they're going to go to the moon again and set up bases on the moon and Mars, whatever for. It's just progress, you know. They want to. They want to conquer the universe. They want to see the stars. You know.
Freedom.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's like a fever. They kind of want to repeat the, you know, the Renaissance going out to America and all that other kind of stuff.
When Prabhupada was in Detroit in 76, we were going out for walks, and you could see in the distance this Renaissance center of movement, and it was just going up at that. Average mentioned that it was his uncle, was one of the main contributors to that Renaissance center of Prabhupada. But he said,
there
will never be a Renaissance.
Yeah, there it is. Okay, so I'll see you day after tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Go by the keys. I have someone by with Tom McKee's.